Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, Mike Peskin from Brian Lehrer and WNYC. In the past decade, the big three car makers got less big, cared less about cars. Trucks and SUVs became the cash cows. One of them was almost wiped out entirely. Now the auto industry, which was once, very recently, the symbol of blight in the U.S. economy, has experienced a turnaround that's been kind of amazing. A bailout, the symbol of government excess to many Americans, turned out to have played a key role in the Renaissance, but so did the personalities of the players and the strategic decisions made along the way. Details of the heretofore unknown backstory of this latest era in American autos is provided in the new book, Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. The author is Bill Vlasic. He joins me on WNYC. Thanks very much for coming on, Bill.
Thank you. Morning, Mike.
You could have picked, the auto industry is 100 years old, and you could have picked any starting point, but you thought the good point for this story was 2005, GM's CEO Rick Wagoner is about to announce earnings to the Wall Street crowd. These earnings are not good. Rick Wagoner is a little upset that Wall Street only cares about that. Why don't you take us to that scene and tell us why you thought this was a good jumping off point?
Well, that happened to be the last time that General Motors ever gave any guidance whatsoever on their financial performance. It was the beginning of the undressing of GM and what was at the heart of its problems, which was making too many cars that people didn't want and paying legacy costs and bills that this corporation could not afford. From that point forward, GM's financial future was in doubt, and within 3 years, the hull of the battleship had cracked completely, and GM was going to Washington for a government bailout.
Why were they making too many cars people didn't want?
You know, GM has been the biggest car company in the world for 70 years at that point. And they nobody told them what to do. They never admitted a mistake. And if they didn't build a car that the public wanted, they'll just try again and build it a second time or a third time or a fourth time. They had divisions such as Pontiac, which sold over 300,000 cars a year but didn't make any money. GM had become almost an HMO. For every dollar they spent on new products and capital expenditures, they were spending a dollar on health care costs for their retirees and active workers, not to mention pensions that were among the best in America, and a lifestyle, if you will, that couldn't be afforded any longer, both white-collar and blue-collar.
It seemed like the forces of capitalism, the positive forces of capitalism, just weren't at play, and they should have been, or maybe they were and GM wasn't recognizing it. But there are so many instances where things like supply and demand and cost control just were out the window when it came to GM.
GM was run by committee. Big, big, big committees. Rick Wagoner happened to have been the chief executive officer during the period when it crashed and went into bankruptcy, but this had been building for many years, and not just at GM. Ford Motor Company as well were posting enormous losses that were, for a while, being covered up by their volumes and by their credit companies, which were loaning consumers money at such a 0% financing for cars that they just kept churning and churning and churning, but not making any real profits. Meanwhile, the competition kept getting better. And this whole struggle financially was really the heat was turned up by the success in the United States of Toyota and Honda, and the idea that you could build a good car in the United States without a labor union and without the kind of overhead that GM was legendary for.
I mean, it got to the point, you might say, or one might say, you wouldn't since you know the situation, but one might say, all right, these cars aren't selling. You have to stockpile them, and that got to be a problem that maybe you could talk about. Okay, so build fewer cars. Why couldn't they just do that?
Well, the big three have been joined at the hip for 50 years, and the thing that keeps them glued together are these UAW contracts. Love them or hate them, they are among the most generous blue-collar contracts in the history of American industry. And the union was very, very skillful for many years in playing the three companies off against each other. That led to a situation that most Americans didn't understand, which was when you don't have enough buyers, you close a plant, but you still pay the workers. People didn't understand that. It's not normal. It's not the kind of thing that in a capitalistic system usually happens. But the fact is, they were building cars, storing them at empty shopping malls, airports, the state fairgrounds here in Detroit, because they couldn't sell them, yet to shut the factories was almost more difficult because they would still have to pay the workers nearly their full wages. Something had to give here.
And you write with, I think, a lot of sympathy about Ron Gettelfinger, who is the 61-year-old president of the UAW, to not paint him as a villain or a guy who is just taking advantage and grabbing with both hands. I mean, we have to realize the history of things was that in post-World War II America, there was no greater business than making cars for this booming economy and all these companies coming back to war. And so buying labor peace on the cheap, which is, you know, a commitment to pensions, which would come back to hurt the car companies, seemed like an astute business move at the time. And, you know, the labor, the UAW guys and the labor guys will always point to, you know, the strategic mistakes that the car companies made. And there is something to that. No, I mean, putting so much of their focus into these big SUVs at the expense of, you know, the green movement.
That's a good point. I absolutely would not lay blame, if you will, on the UAW. The fact is, they got these great contracts when GM, Ford, and Chrysler were making a lot of money in the 1960s, the 1970s, into the 80s. Everybody was getting paid, including the executives. But that system worked when GM, Ford, and Chrysler had 85 or 90% of the American market. When you have 50 or 45% and you're losing share, you can't stick with these old ways. And Ron Gettelfinger is an elected president of a union with several hundred thousand workers, and he's there to defend what they have. And it got pretty tough to keep the health care, to keep the pensions. And in the end, Gettelfinger deserves a lot of admiration for the way he negotiated for his members when GM and Chrysler were going bankrupt. He didn't stand in the way. There was no strike. In the end, the union suffered and became part of the solution, I think.
Because it was just recently announced that we're at the Spring Hill facility. They're adding thousands of jobs, and the UAW has agreed to a second tier of pay, which is about half the pay of what their workers had traditionally received.
That was a huge turning point for the union and for the companies. They can pay entry-level workers about half of what they pay the regular workers, and the union is working to scale them up so one day they'll be full paid as well. But it cuts costs tremendously, allows them much more flexibility, and turns over the population of workers. We have a lot of, you know, 60, 65-year-old auto workers in this country, and my belief is they should work as long as they want. But these companies are changing. They do need these new workers, and they do need a new approach to building cars and actually making money at it.
So back to 2005, or at least that period when GM thought that it could dig itself out of its own troubles. Rick Wagoner, he's the president of GM. He, you know, it was once said of Al Gore that it seems like he was running for president since the third grade. I mean, you can make a similar case about Wagoner, and just that his credentials in terms of being a GM lifer are impeccable. He worked in every division on every continent, but his personality and his experience, how did they both come into play in terms of how he made decisions with that company?
Well, leadership is extremely important in any organization, I believe. And for a while there, when things were tough, the question was, can anybody run a car company? All three companies had gone through CEOs that hadn't worked. And in fact, at Ford Motor Company, they changed leadership, or Bill Ford added a CEO to from the outside to help him turn that company around. The issue at GM and with Wagoner wasn't brains or dedication or hard work. It was the inability to recognize that General Motors could not continue down this path. You can't turn the Titanic a few degrees at a time. They needed a CEO who not only brought a different type of leadership to the company, but could articulate what GM had to do to be to deserve all the accolades it was so used to. I mean, you could not tell the people at GM that they weren't the greatest car company in the world, even when they were losing billions of dollars. It was always other circumstances. The market always would turn. When their new products got to market, that would change everything. When China became the largest car auto market in the world, GM would prosper. It was always, it's coming, it's coming. And by this point in 2005, I think the key there is Wall Street had really run out of patience with General Motors at that point. And it wouldn't be long before some of the more dire forecasts made in 2005 and 2006 came crashing true in 2008 when GM went to Washington for a bailout.
And so that discussion, which was had among the big companies to ask for the bailout, what went into that calculation?
Well, one of the things that I was really surprised, I covered all this for the New York Times during that time period, and but when I researched the book, I was sort of amazed that the three auto executives that went to Washington and Ron Gentlefinger did not discuss it at all before they went. GM led Detroit to Washington. Ford went to protect its own interests. Chrysler went because they were going up belly up faster than GM and needed to tag along and hopefully come out of there with something. But it was GM that led them down there, and I was really interested that there was no discussion whatsoever, no coordination, and more importantly, no message, no plan.
And no strategy into how to craft that message or how to get there, in fact. And we'll get into that in a moment as we continue with Bill Vlasic, whose new book is Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers. We'll talk about the appearance before Congress and the mechanisms of the bailout and a little bit about Bill Ford. Stay with us in a minute on WNYC. Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, speaking with Bill Vlasic, author of Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers. When we last left it, the Big Three were going to Washington, D.C. The situation was Chrysler not doing well, GM doing horribly, and Ford actually doing okay. Sort of went down in a show of solidarity because the Big Three always act in lockstep. Tell me about Ford and how they were able, even at that point, to avoid the fate of GM.
Well, the Ford Motor Company, about the same time that we start the book in 2005, was in the same situation as General Motors. Too much production, not enough cars, too many trucks, and the handwriting was on the wall, and they were in lockstep. But Bill Ford Jr., who is the great-grandson of Henry Ford and the leader of the Ford family, and at the time the chief executive and chairman of the company, had the moment of clarity that he needed some help, someone from the outside, someone with a fresh perspective to help Ford turn itself around or at least change. It needed to change. Bill Ford should get a lot of credit for giving up his job because he felt that someone else could do it better. In the process, Ford also made a big bet. They mortgaged everything they owned to borrow as much money as they could in late 2006, when the financial markets were still lending money to struggling car companies from Detroit, and raised over $20 billion, which turned out to be perhaps the pivotal decision by Bill Ford, the Ford family, the directors, and ultimately Alan Mulally, the new CEO that Bill Ford recruited from Boeing, to get that money and use it wisely to start transitioning away from trucks to smaller, more fuel-efficient cars, and more importantly, have the kind of cash reserves you need when the market turns as badly as it did in 2008.
They seemed also to be less obstinate. Ford had an actual commitment to green cars. They've seen in your book when President Obama and Bill Ford are kind of talking about the future of more fuel-efficient cars and alternative fuels, and they were loving what each other was saying.
And it was a kind of a marriage made in heaven in some degrees. Bill Ford had been the out-of-step, green-minded environmentalist CEO in Detroit, and not necessarily getting a lot of empathy from his other CEOs and executives in Detroit, who thought going around talking about hybrid and electric cars was missing the point when they were making all their money on Suburbans and Expeditions and pickup trucks. But Bill Ford also knew that this kind of change, he had been in the industry 30 years. He grew up in it. This kind of change is wrenching and difficult. And Ford went through a major downsizing, as did GM. One of the things I tried to bring to life in the book is what it was like to live through hundreds of thousands of auto workers losing their jobs. So I have a lot of their voices in there and some of their plants. But Bill Ford, you know, sort of bit the bullet, if you will, decided to take a chance on Mulally, who, although a well-known executive in the aircraft industry, was a total stranger in Detroit, turned out to be one of the great hires in American business history.
And so there they go down to Washington. Bill Ford didn't join them.
It was Rick Wagner, Alan Mulally, and Bob Nardelli, who was the CEO of Chrysler.
Right. And in fact, Bill, when that first appearance in Washington went disastrously, people begged Bill Ford to go down because they know that he could smooth things over. And you indicate in your book, to his credit, he said, no, the CEO is Mulally, and he has to be the one speaking for us. Why did things go disastrously the first meeting?
Well, the environment that GM led them into was totally unreceptive to Detroit. Even in the best of times, you have to remember the automakers, they have gone down there in lockstep to fight about trade with Japan, to fight against higher fuel economy standards, always sort of in an aggressive mode. And going down there was a huge miscalculation in terms of expecting some sort of reception other than a hostile one, where the Congress was up for re-election. The presidential election was still very divisive and had everyone in Washington sort of up in arms. And the fact is the bank bailout, the TARP bailouts, had laid a place for GM to come in and just get themselves beaten up. They weren't ready for it. Ford went along, as I said, out of a show of solidarity, and also they were worried about where the market was going, and they certainly didn't want to see GM just go into some sort of uncontrolled bankruptcy situation, which could have really wreaked havoc with the auto suppliers that Ford also used.
In a second round, GM eventually got its bailout. Chrysler, too. I realize we're not talking a lot about them, but you know they are mm-hmm. Daimler Chrysler, and they're addressed thoroughly in the book. But let's just talk about what we're talking about. The bailout, too simple, too reductive. Say the bailout worked.
Well, it's ironic that here we are 2 years later, and the American auto industry is sort of one of the few bright spots in a very tough economy. Did it work? It certainly kept GM and Chrysler in business. The chances were pretty high that both those companies would have gone out of business if there hadn't been a government-sponsored bankruptcy. They could not get money from any other sources to finance bankruptcies, so they would have been broken up. They would have been sold out. There certainly would have been a lot of jobs lost, and you would have lost the companies themselves. I don't know what would have happened around here in Detroit if the lights went dark forever at the GM headquarters and the Chrysler headquarters, but they didn't. So if that's the measure of success, that they still exist, they're still employing people, paying taxes, selling cars, then yeah, I'd say it's a success. This was sort of a story of survival, and the Obama administration, in my opinion, was mostly motivated by what could happen if they didn't act. I interviewed Steve Ratner, who was the auto czar, and several other members of the auto task force, and they were frankly afraid that if GM did go into a death spiral in bankruptcy without any financial backing, that it would have been a very difficult situation to deal with in an economy that was already turning pretty bad.
If you were an investor in Ford at the doldrums, you could pick up that stock around 5. This year it was as high as 15, now around 10. Unfortunately, GM stock isn't doing well, and you could say, well, okay, so owners of GM stock then have to take the hit. Guess what? I own it and you own it, because the federal government owns about, what, like a quarter of GM?
Federal taxpayers still own 26% of GM, and based on how badly the stock has done the last several months, the taxpayers will lose some money on this investment. What the final accounting will be, whether it's $10 billion, $15 billion, remains to be seen. It's sort of an unusual circumstance that the government was able to sell out its stock as early as May or June of this year, but decided to wait because they thought the price was too low. Well, it was around 29 then. Now GM's down to around 20, or maybe even lower. I think that's a function of the worry about car sales in general and what's going to happen with the economy. But the fact is, there will be a bill to pay at the end for bailing out GM and Chrysler, and the final tally really isn't in yet.
Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, written by Bill Vlasic. Bill, thanks very much for sharing your time.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Really appreciate it.